Hi, I'm Natalie Gochner. You're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle. We're coming to you today from the State Capitol Building. I represent the Political Center, and I have Shireen Gourbani representing the political left. Hi, Shireen.
Hello, and hey to the listeners.
In the same room, and with Dan McKay on the right.
Hey, Merry Christmas, everybody.
Yeah. Well, it's an interesting time of year. We're all trying to take a little bit of time off, and we're going to actually record some of these Both Sides of the Aisle sessions in sequence. We're going to try something a little different. We all have a wonderful relationship off of the air. And we want to have that relationship between the left, right, and center come out over the airwaves. So we're going to spend the next 3 weeks explaining a little bit about ourselves and our political ideologies from the left, right, and center. We're going to do an informal approach, kind of a coffee shop setting. Do you like that, Shireen?
Is that because I drink a lot of coffee? Yes, I do like that.
Yeah, think of the coffee shop music in the background. And I don't know if we flipped a coin or what, but we decided in this first show this week, we're going to focus on the political middle. And so I'm in the hot seat.
It means Shireen and I took all the votes and totally outvoted the centrist, Natalie.
So Dan and Shireen are going to ask me questions. In our first segment, we'll talk a little bit about me personally. And then in the second segment about the political middle and centrist ideology. So I'm turning it over to you two.
Wow, this feels like
power.
It is usually Natalie like flipping it on us.
Yeah,
right?
It's so true. Well, I of course always love to hear people talk about like where'd you grow up and what was your family like? What did they do?
So I'm the youngest of 11 children. So not everyone can say that. Our producer can, Anthony Scoma. Grew up in Salt Lake City. My father was a physician. He was a pediatrician for about 30 years, and then went back to school and got board certified in child and adult psychiatry. So during his last 10 years or so, he was a psychiatrist. So that, you know, has an interesting effect on your children. Dan, I want to just look at you as I say this. I have 7 older brothers.
Wow.
You can imagine how that's affected me.
Yeah.
Went to Olympus High School.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
So you had to be a peacemaker. I mean, as the youngest, it seems like, you know, being the youngest in the family shaped you when you look at all your siblings.
Mm-hmm.
How do you think it shaped you?
I think it's been an incredible gift in my life to have had 10 older siblings that were all very dominating, talented, who very much didn't cut me a lot of slack. Mm. It made me very independent, gave me a lot of, I don't know, I just was really confident in my skin, who I was. Because I didn't have them to really lean on. They kind of lived their lives. And my parents, because I was the youngest of 11, they pretty much finished parenting, you know, with number 7. And so I had a lot of freedom. Hmm. And, you know, hopefully use that freedom to create something good.
Yeah.
Were they political?
So my father was a Republican. My mother liked Hubert Humphrey. That kind of dates her a little bit, but I would say that I had a mixed household in that respect. And when you have 11 children, you get a little bit of everything. So I have some very liberal siblings, not many.
Mm-hmm.
And I have some that are, you know, very conservative, and maybe that's why I ended up in the middle, Shireen.
So with your, like, okay, when was the first time you remember, like, being somewhat interested in politics, mm-hmm. or because it's been such a substantial part of your life.
Mm-hmm.
What's the first thing you remember being interested in?
I'm older than the two of you, so this won't ring as true to you, but the Vietnam War.
Interesting.
Yeah, okay. Because, you know, Walter Cronkite was...
How old were you?
Well, I mean, I was born in 62.
Mm-hmm.
And so these memories are probably coming from 66, 67, 68.
Very
you
know, young.
To 72,
yeah.
Somewhere in there.
Yeah.
But Walter Cronkite's broadcasting the news. You're seeing body bags on TV. Mm. And I had a brother that served in Vietnam.
Mm.
And I remember my mother planting a tree the day he left. You know, I remember seeing the pictures that he would send home from Vietnam. And he was not a fan of President Nixon. I remember he took one of the bumper stickers that was re-elect Nixon and he changed it to say reject Nixon. Mm. He folded it or something.
Yeah.
But those were some of the early sentiments where I guess I, you could say I grew up at a time when there was a lot of political controversy.
Yeah. What about in the transition, kind of thinking through, you know, out of high school,
mm-hmm.
where'd you go to school and what were you involved in? What mm-hmm. kind of stuff led to the public service?
Well, so I had these older brothers and sisters and they're, I have a brother that's a, a musician, professional musician. I have a brother, I have a, several brothers that got their PhDs. I have a brother that chairs the anesthesiology department, University of Utah. I have a sister that was a stockbroker. I mean, I had all these examples ahead of me, so I didn't know what I was going to do, right? But a really important teacher in high school touched me, and it was an anthropology class. And I read, and not many high schools teach anthropology, but they did at Olympus High. And I registered as an anthropology major, took cultural and physical anthropology, and decided it wasn't for me, but I took my first Econ 101 class, and I just, my mind lit up. And I took every economics class I could take. And so I graduated with both an undergraduate and graduate degree from the University of Utah in economics, and landed the perfect job out of college, working in the governor's office of planning and budget for Norm Bangeter.
That was your first
job. That'll date me. Yeah. 1985, working when Governor Bangeter was a governor. And if you think back that far, it was a tough time in our state. We were having out migration. We were still dealing with floods. They built the big pumps on Great Salt Lake. They had Syncrete on I-15. You guys won't remember this, but there were all these things that made it a really tumultuous time in a governor's office. John Huntsman Sr., from an intra-party challenge, announced he was going to, you know, take Governor Bangeter on. And so I watched all of these kinds of dynamics as a young economist in the governor's office.
Which is super interesting. You know, if for our listeners who've never listened to or read, you know, I read Mormon Rivals, and just some of the background of like early, you know, the kind of the fighting between Bangeter and, you know, John Huntsman Sr. And that was an interesting race and how that whole thing played out. Anyway.
Well, and Ted Wilson challenged Governor Bangeter. And, you know, I remember going to bed thinking that Wilson had won it. And I remember getting up at 5 a.m. I'm a political appointee. I need Wilson to lose to keep my job, probably. I don't know. But I remember Wilson had a really bad, he'll tell you this, last debate. And it really affected him.
Yeah.
So Bangeter ends up winning. And at the time, you have to remember, we'd had a lot of Democratic governors.
Yeah.
So it was kind of new to have a Republican governor in our state. Believe it or not, Shireen.
Yeah.
It is true. You know, you had Rampton and Matheson held the office for, you know, decades.
Decades.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I don't want to get away from personal yet.
Like, but I know I was going to ask about your family. So were you raising a family when this was happening? Or?
Right. So I married just this incredible man, Chris Gochner. He's a furniture maker.
How'd you meet?
We met at Arches National Park, believe it or not, at the Arch, at Delicate Arch.
What was his pickup line?
On a senior trip, I was with some sorority friends, and he was there with another gal. Yeah, he'll love that I mentioned that. But you know, my husband, you'll just find this interesting. He was the poster child for Winterstick, which is the first snowboard, you know, in the Western United States. There was Burton Board in the East and Winterstick in the West. And my husband's sort of a bit of a famous skateboarder and snowboarder of his time, and turned all of that. He used to make his own skateboards and winter sticks, and he turned that into furniture.
Yes.
So I married a bit of a craftsman. Well, not a bit, an incredible craftsman.
We have
two beautiful children, a son and a daughter. One went to Arizona State University and is in the kind of creative fields. And my son, Theo, is an engineer, just graduated from college, has his first engineering job.
And your daughter is a pretty strong fan of the show, too. I mean,
both of them probably. Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah. But they're both more on Shireen's side, and they do like you, Dan, and they better than they liked some of the earlier rides. They, whatever reason, had trouble with Greg Hughes.
My favorite is I'll get a text from
Greg will like me for that.
I'll hear from Natalie or something. Yeah. That something you said really just made my daughter pull her hair out. So I totally appreciate that.
Well, and you have some interesting hobbies yourself.
Ukulele, what are you thinking?
Yeah, ukulele. I'm thinking about the ukulele.
Yeah. What I would more be known for is soccer.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I played for 25 years. And when Brandi Chastain was in Los Angeles when the USA played China in the World Cup final, I was there. And I'm a big soccer fan.
And what position did you play?
You know, when you play for 25 years, you play about all of them.
Yeah.
I started up top as a forward. Then went to the midfield and ended my career as a right fullback.
Yeah.
But my favorite is playing in the midfield. I like to distribute the ball, which is about what you do in the political middle, by the way.
Very on brand. That's a very good point.
Yeah.
Oh, that's awesome. Okay. So your kids are now out of the house, right? They're all graduated and you're focusing full time. Tell us what you're doing like professionally right now.
Mm-hmm. Well, I lead the Kempsey Gardner Policy Institute, and it's really the honor of my professional career to do that. If you think about it, I worked for three different governors. I worked as a political appointee in Washington. I served the business community, managing the public affairs, the public policy work of the Salt Lake Chamber. And all of that prepared me, I think, quite well to you know, be in charge of one of the state's premier public policy institutes. So we started the Gardner Policy Institute just over 5 years ago, and we do amazing work. I have a team of about 30 people, and I just praise them to the rooftops. Some great analysts, economists, demographers, sociologists, geographers, you name it.
Mm. Well, that's, I mean, people don't know this. Maybe they do, maybe they don't. I mean, I feel like anytime there's a problem in the state, it was like, I wonder what Natalie thinks of this. Do you know what I mean? Like it used to surprise me when I first got involved. It's like, man, this Natalie is everywhere. You know, the first couple of years that I was up here in the legislature, Natalie's everywhere. Like she's presenting at this. I'm listening to her here. I'm listening. It's pretty much like public policy, whatever Natalie, you know, I was like, boy, I really need to get to know Natalie better. And, you know, they asked me to sub in the show one time. And that was really kind of the first foray into getting to know Natalie. And now I find myself the same thing. It's like, well, here's a public policy issue. Boy, I wonder what Natalie thinks.
Mm. Well, that's the product of both great mentors, but also just, you know, I tell people if you get up every day for 35 years and do this kind of stuff, by year 32, 33, people will care what you think. It's just the rule. So I've been at it a long time.
It's suffering those 31 years.
I will say, though, I had incredible mentors, and Governor Leavitt is you know, easily the most significant professional mentor in my life. Hmm. And he's an incredibly gifted person and taught me a lot.
That might be a good transition for us to take a little break and come back and get into more of the kind of roots of those political beliefs and where you think you're headed.
Let's do it. I'm Natalie Gochner. I'm with Shireen Gourvani and Dan McKay. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle on KCPW. For more episodes of all our in-house podcasts, click on the Local Programs tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider donating to KCPW to support public radio in your community.
Dan McKay on the right.
Shireen Gourvani on the left.
Natalie Gochner in the Political Center, and this is Both Sides of the Aisle. We're talking about mainstream political ideology in this segment, so I'm going to turn the time back over to you, Shireen.
So I asked listeners, followers, people who interact with me that enjoy the show, what questions they would have. And one of the questions that came up over and over again was if you could talk about what you think it is that plants you in the middle. What makes you a centrist? What is driving that? And what do you think maybe defines you as not right? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, okay. Two points I'd make there, and we've already talked about some of them. I mean, when you come from a family of 11 kids with seven older brothers, you crave sort of an egalitarian, you know, balanced, civil, peaceful existence. You know, just imagine all these rugrats and all the things going on in the Egan household. My maiden name's Egan, and I think that really had an effect on me.
Yeah.
But the second thing that I would just mention is very early in my professional development, I worked with centrists. Mm. So you think of Governor Bangeter, mm-hmm. Governor Leavitt, Governor Walker, even after I came back from Washington, did a lot of work with Governor Huntsman, Governor Herbert. Our governors are in the political middle. And I'm, you know, if people say, what kind of Republican are you? I'll say, I'm a Bangeter Republican. I'm a Leavitt Republican. I'm a Walker Republican. They sort of, you know, groomed me, and I watched as they led through some pretty tough things. And really what they did is they listened to people that were Democrats, and they listened to people that were Republicans, and then they took the best ideas from both. Mm-hmm. So that's how I approach it.
Hmm. Is it, you know, I think about that type of ideology, not necessarily ideology, but just, do you think that comes from a interest in like following the data more than it does like a mm-hmm. specific dogma? Is that the balance you're constantly trying to battle with?
Yeah. Dan, just even the thought of dogma, I don't like, you know? And so
it's a terrible word. Maybe it's like a principle.
But just even, you know, it's the same thing of, you know, are you a partisan or are you an American? You know, I'm an American.
Yeah.
You know, and
logical trap.
Yeah. And, you know, when you interact with politicians, you see politics up close. And I have never held, I worked in government service for 20 years, but I'd never been career service. I'd always been at will, which means you're a political appointee. And that, so I'm always working close to a politician, and I didn't like the political part of the job, you know, and maybe a good way to explain it is a politician has to prepare for how they're going to ask questions, how they're going to answer questions about the NRA and guns. Politicians have to prepare for how they're going to answer questions about abortion, things like that. And I think you should just be yourself. And so it makes it hard for me to be a partisan and very easy for me to be a policy person.
Oh, interesting.
What are some of the, maybe from the left and the right, if you could pick one idea from kind of each right now that is really exciting to you when you're thinking about maybe the next few years or opportunities, could you maybe identify one of each that gets you excited?
Well, I'm gonna give you one that both are drawn to, and that is what's called localism. And so both the Brookings Institution and the American Enterprise Institute are writing a lot about localism, and it's the idea that we solve our problems closest to us. So it really means that states are where things are going to happen. And you see the federal government just struggling to do anything. And then you see what can happen at the local level, you know. And Shireen, I know you care a lot about health policy. I think our state can do amazing things in health policy without the chains of the federal government.
Yeah.
So localism is one of the things that I think has a really bright future, and you're going to see more talk about it.
How that's, I want to probe a little bit deeper. Like, you know, how does, you talk about healthcare and some of those problems. How has that really shaped like your policy? Cause you know, you saw, and you've been at the national level, right? And you start at the local level, moved at the national level. How does that really, as you look back on your career, how has that localism changed?
Well, I'll tell you, one thing that hasn't changed is the problems of extremism. And it's maybe why localism becomes more important. You know, one of the most important political lessons or policy lessons I've ever learned is that the extremes are more of a personality mix than they are an ideology. So that takes a little bit of explaining for me to do that. But if you think of a spectrum, left all the way to the right, are the left and the right closer to the people right next to them on that ideology, or are they more like each other? And I would argue that the extremes are more like each other because it's more of a personality trait than it is a policy trait. So to make that real, think of environmentalism. Think of a bumper sticker that says, you know, save the planet, kill yourself. And one that says, you know, Earth first, we'll mine the other planets later. Okay. Yeah, so there's supposed to be two kind of extremes. It's you know, both are ridiculous points of view. And I think that it's in problem solving and the political middle that where you start to actually do things in policy. It's not the extreme voices that make things happen. I watched welfare reform happen. Governor Leavitt was a new governor. President Clinton. And they found a way to reform welfare in our country. That was the political middle shining out. And I'd love to see that in healthcare, and I'd love to see it in environmental policy and climate change, all sorts of places.
What's something that you're most proud of?
In
your life's work.
Career.
You get to pick.
Yeah. Well, you know, so they all come from the political middle. The 2002 Olympic Winter Games were a big part of my, professional life.
Yeah.
I took a call from, you know, the leader of the Olympic movement when Anchorage, Alaska was thrown overboard and the U.S. Olympic Committee decided to reopen the bid. And, I took that, I'm working in the Capitol and my boss was an economist. They needed economic work done. And this guy's at an airport just before he boards a plane and calls us to just say, are you on the team? We need some economists to help. And that would have been in about 1987 or something. And anyway, I rode that all the way through till the end.
3 years after Mary Lou Retton had landed a perfect 10 off the ball, by the way.
But you think of that. So 87 to 2003, I'm living that. And I remember constructing the spreadsheets that figured out the original sales tax diversion to build the Olympic facilities. And by the time the Olympics are here, I'm a you know, I'm a right-hand person to the governor and basically just got to meet all these cabinet members and watched our state shine. So that's probably the premier thing, but there's all sorts of little things along the way.
Yeah.
Really proud of transit funding. I did a lot of work at the chamber to get a light rail funded. I'm really proud of the Utah Compact and immigration reform. Those are just a few.
Yeah.
Well, and you know, if you think about, I'm just thinking about the things that you've named off, Natalie, and your role in each one of those things and how they've shaped, I'd just say modern Utah history is pretty spectacular. You know, it's really interesting when you talk about, I think, you know, we can talk about this more another time, but I think one of the things that my daughters lack are good women role models, because history done just does a bad job really of documenting the woman's contribution, you know, to a lot of things in the state of Utah. And hearing those things that you've been involved in, you know, we really need to capture
that history better.
A lot of those things, right?
Yeah. 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 It seems like you've probably been over your career, I would guess there have been a lot of opportunities where, or a lot of moments when you were the only woman in the room. Is that true?
Yeah. You know, I did not choose to be a professional woman. It just sort of happened. That sounds kind of interesting in and of itself, just saying that. But, you know, I was working hard and opportunities kept coming to bear, and I would walk through the door of those opportunities. And I had a very supportive husband and healthy children and, you know, was able to do it. But I always tell young women who are pursuing a professional career that there's no magic recipe. And it's the hardest thing I've ever done is try to be a mother and a professional woman.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I had everything going for me. Supportive husband, healthy children, parents that lived in the valley with me, a great employer, and still incredibly difficult.
Yeah.
So I look at you, Shireen, as I say this. So it's really hard for women, and it's essential that they be in the workforce because when you don't have a woman's voice, it's not as good.
Yeah.
No, I have a lot of feelings about that.
Yeah, I think we really suffer when we don't have a diversity of perspective at the table.
In my own mind, I've sort of framed it this way, that the female values, feminine values, the way to say it, are things like civility and beauty and stewardship. Mm-hmm. And those are, you know, and men can have those too, but they seem to be very dominant in women.
But they don't make the news.
Yeah.
And they don't, you know, I've just, as you mentioned those things off, I'm like, well, those things don't make the news.
Yeah.
And they don't, you know, they don't get written about often enough. But when you look around a community, you can see the indelible fingerprint of all of those things.
Yeah. And we need more of them.
Community.
And we need more of them.
And then they're also central to your faith.
Yeah, sure they are. Yeah. And if you go to the traditionally more male values, masculine values, it's competition and power and strength. Mm. And so the way I've framed them in my own mind is that either of them alone is a problem. Mm. If you have the male values taken to an extreme, it can be abuse. And and if you take the female values taken to their extreme, because they don't have that strength, they're never heard. Mm. And you have to put them together. So, you know, you have to take that center of strength and that center of goodness and put them together.
We only have a couple minutes left.
Well, I've got the transition here to the end. So we've talked about how this has been an unusual and difficult year for many. Tell me about what you're thinking to, maybe some lessons you've learned or what you're thinking to for the future here.
Well, I'm an optimist by nature. That's a gift I got from my mother. I think, you know, 2020 has been unbelievable in every way. I was speaking to my daughter today and found myself saying to her, I'm a better person because of 2020. And I believe that others have become better. It's strengthened us and we learn to appreciate things more. So I'm looking for 2021 to get a bump because just like you have pent up demand in economics, like people are going to go travel more because we haven't been doing it. I think because of our goodness, it's going to take a bump. And I think by later 2021, life will feel quite different and it'll be better.
What are you most looking forward to?
I'm looking forward to taking a trip to London with my husband. That's sort of the thing I've been holding out there. I love Europe. My husband served an LDS mission in London, England. Mm. It's a place he knows really well. Mm. We go there from time to time. I want to go to the West End and see a few plays and eat some dinner and go to some historic sites and just relish in the fact that 2020 ended.
There's an Indian food place right around the corner.
Love it. Lots of good East Indian in there.
Love it down there. Anyway.
Well, I feel like you don't really love being the center of attention, and I appreciate your willingness to to share a little bit about yourself.
It has been like a moment of like my favorite little needle is when we can like lift Natalie up, and so that people recognize like how special it is this person that we get to talk to every week. And,
yeah,
she makes time for us, and here we are.
Thanks everybody for your interest. I'm Natalie Gochner in the Political Center. Shireen Gourbani on the left, Dan McKay on the right. Thanks everybody.